Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody, to Somewhere in Vegas here on blogtalkradio.com. I'm Mark the Q. I'm your host. Coming up in the bottom of the hour, we're going to have a very talented author and musician, Tia Graff, will be joining us at the bottom of the hour. But I'm very privileged right now to have somebody who's a great actor as well as a great talent in terms of comedy. He's going to be doing a lot of dates around the L.A. area, but he'll be back here in Vegas at the L.A. Comedy Club in the Stratosphere come September. Will C is on with us right now. How are you doing, Will?
I'm doing outstanding. How are you?
I'm doing great. I mean, it's been kind of an interesting ride for you. I mean, just to be able to both do comedy and acting as well. I mean, tell me a little bit, first of all, about how you got into acting.
Okay, well, since I was a kid, I think I was in every production I could get into starting at a young age, and really didn't know that's what I wanted to be per se, but I joined the military instead when I was 17. I went into the Air Force, and I came out of the Air Force. I went to college. I have a theater degree and came out of the Air Force, came out of college. I joined the Marine Corps, did my time in the Marine Corps. I came out of the Marine Corps. I joined the Army. So I'm a three-branch veteran in the military. And then I started really just hitting the comedy circuit really hard. While I was in the military, I did a couple productions. When I come home on leave back to Kansas City, I was able to get into a couple movies. I'm just doing background work, not really a big deal, but fun. But then 11 years ago, I got really lucky, and a buddy of mine had written a movie shooting in Los Angeles. I was living back in Kansas City at the time, and he wanted me to come out for 3 months on this production and be a military consultant, just showing people how to wear their uniform properly, get that gig line straight, no big deal, and then just a small part. And so I pack up the car and I start heading toward Los Angeles, and I get a phone call, and it's him. And he's like, "Hey, Will, I'm sorry, buddy, but there's a writer's strike going on. I had to scratch the project." And I'm like, "You got to be kidding me." And I go, "I'm in Moriarty, New Mexico. Like, I'm almost there." And he's like, "I don't know what to tell you, man." So I get off the phone with him, and I call my wife, and I'm like, "Well, I guess I'm turning the car around and coming home. They scratched the project." But my wife was like, "Slow down, partner. Look, I've already kissed you, and mentally I'm ready for you to be gone for about 3 months." And I'm like, "I don't even know what that means, but okay." So I decided to go on to California, and when I got there, everybody was like, "Sign up with Central Casting." So I did that. And everybody's like, "You know, just I hope you have a lot of patience. It's going to take you 5-10 years to make it, whatever." I was in town for 2 weeks, and I get a call from Central Casting. They're like, "Hey, we're shooting this commercial for Absolut Vodka. We're sponsoring Kanye West on his world tour. Would you like to be a background actor?" And I'm like, "Well, how much does that pay?" And they're like, "Well, you're non-union, so it's $56 for 8 hours. And I'm like, $7 an hour, huh? That sucks. But I'll take it. So I went on up to set, and I get there, and I'm lost. I don't know what I'm doing. I wander my way into wardrobe department and start talking to this guy. Well, then all of a sudden, here comes Kanye with his entourage. They come down the hall, and Kanye just walks up to me and kind of eyes me from head to toe, no big deal. But he looks at the wardrobe guy, and he's like, "Who's this guy?" And they're like, "Oh, Kanye, Mr. West, we are so sorry, so sorry. He's a background, non-union piece of shit, basically. You need to go away." And Kanye was like, "You know what? No. I want this guy to be the bouncer in that commercial." That guy was in hair and makeup. SAG actor getting ready to go on set. Kanye walks in, he's like, "Yeah, I don't need you anymore. This guy's going to replace you. You're going to get paid your day rate." I got Taft-Hartley right on the spot, automatic SAG, made a buttload of money on that commercial, and basically the rest is history. Because of that commercial, I landed my first agent in Los Angeles, and I ended up on a show called Mansers on Spike TV, and did that for like 4 years, on the street interviews, reenactments. But during that time, I got to be in a lot of commercials for Verizon and Dodge, and then I landed a Monk in the Office, and My Name is Earl, and Knight Rider and Sons of Anarchy, and then I ended up being the handyman on Gene Simmons' Family Jewels. From that, I landed, my buddy wrote a whole show. It was called Storage Hunters, and just happened to, I got really lucky with that show. I was Big Will on Storage Hunters for 2 years on True TV. During that time, I was also in Yes Man with Jim Carrey and 7 Pounds with Will Smith and Heron Vice with Joaquin Phoenix. I got to do Hail Caesar with George Clooney and Gone Girl with Ben Affleck, and just, I know I'm name-dropping, but it's just, you know, I just want your listeners to know what famous is. Just joking. I just got really fortunate and really blessed with everything that was kind of coming down my way. And, Modern Family and Mom and all these other shows I got to be part of. And it's just been a really cool thing. And at the same time, being a veteran, it's just really been a really cool thing to be able to give back now with what I do with the military. And so that's kind of where I'm at in my career right now, acting a lot and traveling the world performing for our troops.
Yeah, I had so many guests that, sometimes it's just happy coincidences that happen where, they see an opportunity. And, sometimes you think that you're making the wrong decision, but something ends up coming out great at the end. So, I mean, that's a great story in terms of, kind of sticking to it as well. I mean, if you would have said no and would have been a little bit of a snob saying, oh no, I mean, $7 an hour isn't really worth my time. You wouldn't have be where you are today. It's just great to be able to take those opportunities.
I'm probably the only one with a good Kanye West story.
Did the comedy come out of the fact that, you were doing a lot more improv and you had a lot of these stories? I mean, how did the comedy come about in terms of doing stand-up? Was that something that you something that you were kind of thinking about, or was that something that kind of was kind of for the moment?
You know, I was a chubby kid, the one that, I got made fun of. But what I benefited was I played sports. And even though I was chubby, I played sports. And I was a class clown. So I was always that funny guy. I got a hold of a Red Fox album when I was younger that changed my life. And I loved stand-up. I loved watching it. I loved Saturday Night Live as a kid. And I liked that whole improv aspect of it. I was a big, believe it or not, Carol Burnett and Friends and things like that. You'd watch these old episodes and you'd be like, oh, wow, that's really funny. I love that sketch comedy. And then I got involved in improv and comedy sports and all those things. And I kind of, when I got in the Marine Corps, honestly, back in 1995, my buddies dared me to go to La Jolla to the Comedy Store in La Jolla, California. They had an open mic night there. And I didn't know what I was doing. And it was horrible. I mean, I know it was horrible. And when I came off stage, I was told how horrible I am. But at the same time, if you tell me I can't do something, I'm going to keep doing it. And so I just kept going back. And little by little, I just got better and better, and I ended up back here in Kansas City. In Kansas, Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, in the Army, not in the jail, but I worked there in the Army. But there was a comedy club in Kansas City called Stanford and Sons, and, they'd give me a lot of time. They made me their house MC. I just got a lot of stage time. And then when everything just kind of came down with the California thing, it was my time to go to California. And yeah, did I get lucky? I did. Absolutely. I got lucky, but I was also ready, if that makes sense. I know they say you put yourself in the right place at the right time, good things will happen. And that was my day. I was in the right place at the right time and it changed my life.
Yeah. As they say, prepare, you prepare, if you prepare for opportunities, you don't wait on opportunities to then prepare later, you don't necessarily do that. So it's always nice to be prepared when that kind of situation happens. It's kind of interesting because, I've talked to comedians in the past about the idea of, almost improv is almost, is comedy almost with a net where, you've got other actors on there that can kind of pick up some of the slack if something happens. But when it comes to stand-up comedy, it's just you out there and having to, it's only you by yourself. So if you stumble, if you start bombing, then it's all on you. How is it for you to have taken some of those skills from the improv class over to the comedy realm? And, I mean, what were some of the hurdles that you had to overcome when you were making that transition over from being more of an improv / actor to being a comedian?
That's a great question. I'll be honest with you. When I the improv probably actually saved me. I knew I wanted to do this, but I didn't really know how to get out there on the road and do it. And actually, I called a comedy club in West Virginia and lied and acted like I was an agent and got myself booked as a feature and for doing 30 minutes a night. I had no business doing that. I had maybe 5 minutes of material and got myself booked in this club. And I was so nervous, I probably went through my 5 minutes in 3 minutes. And then I still had 27 minutes. So, you just start improv and you're like, hey, black shirt. Hey, what's going on? Red shirt, red hair. And I, at the end of the week, the lady hands me the money and she's like, I can't believe I never heard of you. And I'm like, I can't believe you never heard of me either. And I just kind of walked out and I never looked back. Just like, I can do this. Improv can totally, they say you have like 30 seconds to judge your audience and you better be really prepared. You can't be so committed to a joke or to a set of jokes if you're not having your audience on board with you. And I think improv really helps in the fact that, sometimes, you have to take a different direction. Sometimes somebody might say something in the audience and you have to be prepared for that. If you want to call it heckling or whatever you want to call it, you have to be ready for that. And I think improv prepares me for that. If anything, I'm ready for something. If it comes at me, I can go a different direction because of the training I have. I'm lucky because I'm a rapid fire comic. So, it's like, I don't get heckled a lot because people want to hear what's coming out next. But I will say that in my writing of my comedy, the way I do my sets and the way I write my jokes, it leaves me room to improv, if that makes sense to you. So
on your feet a little bit, there's those classic stories about when comedians were on Carson, where they, if you can get tripped up sometimes because sometimes some of the newer comedians don't realize that there could be a laugh break, and that kind of stumbles up on terms of their timing and then
correct.
There's always kind of the wrap up thing. So it's something that you have to kind of think on your feet in terms of that as well.
Absolutely.
And when you're talking about the idea of the audience, engaging that audience, obviously if you're the first comic up or the well, hopefully you have a good enough MC where, they're going to be able to kind of gauge the crowd as it were. But, there's usually that sweet spot in the middle where you kind of know where the crowd is. They're warmed up. You kind of see where everything's kind of heading. Is there any certain spot that you personally like to be in terms of the lineup?
Well, I mean, where I'm at in my career now, it's like you're headlining the gigs, and so you are last. And a feature spot's actually, that's the sweet spot because you don't have to worry about checks getting dropped during your set, waitresses trying to collect money, people trying to figure out, tipping on their whatever, oh, I can't believe I drank that. So sometimes, even though you get the status of the headliner or, the money that comes with it, sometimes in all actuality, it's tough because you do have all that going on. Now, I personally like to watch. I get to a comedy club early, and it's one thing I'm known for is I like to watch the crowd come in. I like to get a feel for them. I like to see if they're communicating with each other, if people are laughing. And, sometimes comedy clubs and venues will play, like America's Funniest Videos before shows, up on the screens and stuff. And you can kind of gauge an audience sometimes off that stuff by what they're laughing at. I really pay attention to, how's that feature act doing? Because if that feature act, what kind of laughs are they getting? Even the MC, are they getting laughs? What's this audience? What are they, what are they into? And then, you know what direction you need to go with your set. So I'm very observation, as to what's going on around me. I am really good at reading an audience. I think that's one thing that I can say that I'm good at is I get a feel for my audience really quick. And then it lets me know, how you need to approach it.
Was it kind of a culture shock for you to go from a club like, in West Virginia or Kansas City to, performing out in California? I mean, obviously they're slightly different crowds, and they've always said that there's always kind of different crowds. LA is a little bit harder market, I hear, and sometimes New York is even a hard market as well. But how was it for you to kind of make that transition over to some of the LA comedy scene? Obviously, the opportunities aren't as rich and fulfilling as it was maybe in a city like Kansas City or West Virginia,
right,
or any place else.
They say that you find you'll find your voice, and your voice will change through comedies. But I mean, I've been in this for over 23 years. And so I remember, when I first started, it was, it was military, and it was, you know, you're making fun of drill instructors, and you're trying to make your military buddies laugh. And then, you know, I went through this phase in my comedy where it was really Italian. You know, I'm like, that was my look. It was the black dress shirt. It was, you know, black. And then it's like, I started really going more towards my, you know, being from Kansas City and the more blue collar thing, you know, but that market was pretty much, you know, Larry and those guys, they had that market. And when I moved to LA, I came to LA in cowboy boots and plaid shirts. And all of a sudden you're wearing Chuck Taylors and Levi's and t-shirts and, you know, LA, it changes you. And then you realize that, you know, your voice is your voice, not your clothes. And once I, you know, I really got to where I was like, okay, my act is who I am, not my clothes aren't defining me per se. Then it's like you realize, but I'll tell you, LA can be very, I've watched it spit guys out. You know, every day comics come to LA thinking that they're going to make it, you know. And it's a different game. New York is totally different, you know. It's just, they are, there's been kind of a swing in comedy. It's it comes and goes in phases. You know, it was the edgy, off-the-cuff kind of comedy was big there for a while, and it's like it's kind of coming back around to, then it was like storytelling. And that's kind of when storytelling era kind of right now. The way I came up in comedy, it was you had to get a laugh every 15 seconds. And I did the rules of three. It's set up, punch. Now it seems like, you know, longer stories, you know, and you hope to God that you tell the story that your punch is going to pay off. It's you got to be prepared, I would say, in L.A. to answer your questions. I mean, you're going to get a lot of no's. You know, you're going to – not everybody gets fortunate. You know, I was very lucky. I started at the comedy store. You know, not everybody gets that benefit of, you know, having that luxury in comedy. And I think I got – but even the comedy stores, you know, you have to pay your dues. And, you know, it's not every show is going to kill over at the improv, you know. But if you get on those shows, you know, and you're – work in the Laugh Factory and all the places, but in LA there's all these other rooms, you know, and you have Ha Ha Comedy Club and, you know, it used to be John Lovitz and different, you know, different places you hit. And because it's touristy, you kind of, you luck out a little bit because they're, you know, compared to New York where you're performing and these are locals and these are people that are, you know, you're grinding. I would say New York is more of a grind, where L.A. is more of you're coming to L.A., you're trying to hopefully work on your acting career as well. That's kind of what L.A. is for. You're hoping to be discovered for a sitcom or, you know, hit a late show or whatever, where New York is more about, you know, it's strict comedy. You get up on New York, you can get up, you know, four or five times a night and make a living, you know, where L.A. is, you know, the stuff don't pay as much in L.A. as they do in New York. But you're, like I said, you're hoping that you're getting that somebody's going to notice you kind of thing. And so you're constantly just working on that tight eight. You're working on that eight minute set that hopefully is going to impress the right people. And it's tough coming, you know, I came from the Midwest and, you know, you come as a road dog. And so you're already established out there on the road. And you think that you're somebody and then you get to LA and you're just like, you know, so you have to really set yourself apart, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it is kind of the thing where, you know, you're a big fish in a small pond out there in anywhere else but L.A. And then, you know, the comedy scene, for a while there, the comedy scene wasn't doing very well. And then it just made this huge resurgence once the millennia came around.
Correct.
And, you know, it's just kind of those things where, you know, you got to come with it, you know, knowing that you're going to have to work, you're going to have to grind your way up, just like, you know, you were mentioning in the earlier story about, you know, the idea that, you know, you're only working for $7, but that, you know, even if you didn't meet Kanye, I mean, that's a start and that's where you can get going. I mean, I hear stories, we were talking about our good friend Adam Hunter earlier, before we went on the air. I mean, yeah, this is a guy that was doing the grind for a very, very long time. He has his own comedy show on Mondays, and he, you know, and he works with comics that are, you know, sometimes feel a little bit privileged, you know, like that they're getting, you know, their 5 minutes or whatever. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you got to kind of work, And it makes you a stronger comedian just to go through the kind of grind. I mean, there's, you know, stories I've heard from other comedians about not just being in L.A., but just you know, working on the road, you know, at some, you know, some place in the middle of nowhere. And they'll, you know, you'll just start doing that tour, and, you know, you kind of take your bumps and bruises that way. But you learn a lot as a comic, as strong as a comic. So I think that's really important for somebody to be a comic, just to be able to have those experiences as well. Interesting.
I love Adam's grind.
Yeah.
No, I
yeah,
just say you were talking
I
about
do
Adam.
Too.
That guy would do comedy in laundromats, wherever he could get somebody to pay attention to him. That guy has grinded and grinded and grinded to get his success. I mean, that's one guy I'm very, I'm honored to know, and just, man, he is a hustler. He's a worker, man. It pays off. You put the work in, it's going to pay off.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and he's starting to reap the benefits now, which is nice. You know, I know he's still doing his thing, but he's really expanding his empire a little bit. So he's doing a really good job. If there's a person that, you know, a comedian that needs to, look towards, to, you know, who is a really hard worker and all that as well, I think Adam's it. Yeah, you were talking earlier about the idea that, you know, we're going into the more of the storytelling kind of situation when it comes to the comedy now, which is kind of it was kind of ironic, because considering the attention spans of people nowadays, some like the little more witty kind of stuff. You'd figure that the quicker witty stuff would be a little bit more popular now, but yeah, it just seems like it's interesting. Kind of it's interesting that ends up being the thing that people want to see the most.
See, for me, I thought that. This is—I don't even know how this is going to be taken, but when people come to comedy clubs, a lot of times they've worked all day. They want to laugh, but at the same time, they're mentally drained. So it's like I always thought my comedy needed to be quick and not make them think. You know, it's almost where you know this is where you're supposed to laugh, kind of thing. It's almost like you're catering to or dumbing it down a little bit. And so now, and I agree with you. It's like now here's these long stories. And I'm like, I'm watching the comedy now, and I'm like, yes, it's funny, and I get it, but it's like sometimes it takes a long time to get to the punch. And I'm like, exactly what you just said. I'm like, how are they keeping the audience's attention, you know? So it's a different swing right now. It really is.
Yeah. It's just really interesting. Well, that seems to be the case. I don't know if it's because of podcasting or, you know what, but yeah, a lot of times it's just weird that, you know, with the short attention spans that people have nowadays, it's just kind of weird. You know, it's great to be able to see just the scene so active nowadays. I mean, do you stay in the LA area pretty much, or do you go out touring? I know you're going to be up here in Vegas in September, but do you go touring very much? I mean, I know you go overseas. I mean, that's obviously a privilege.
Yes, I mean, I love performing overseas for the troops. I have a group called the Veterans of Comedy that I founded with another veteran, a buddy of mine named Eric Knowles, who, believe it or not, was a World Series of Comedy winner in 2016 there in Las Vegas. We founded a group in 2014 called the Veterans of Comedy. We're all military veterans that are now stand-up comedians, and we actually tour nonstop. We're actually we get employed by the Department of Defense, and we go from base to base, and Eric and I wrote a series called Combat to Comedy, and basically we work with our transitioning veterans. A lot of them are, you know, injured, whether it be visibly or invisible wounds. They're getting med boarded out of the military, and there's a lot of depression that goes with that. And so we kind of fight fear with funny with this series called Combat to Comedy. So we're very fortunate to be able to do, you know, to do that and to travel the way we do. And then we perform. I know that comics always want to go overseas, you know, and they want to say, hey, I performed overseas for the troops, and we do that. But a lot of times, we have a lot of bases here in the States that get forgotten about. And so we started concentrating on performing for our troops that are here in the States as well. And so, and really addressing, you know, the 22 a day and things like that. And so we do, we tour nonstop around the States as well and go from installation to installation. I got, you know, a lot of bases coming up on tour right now. Get ready to do Fort Riley, Kansas here August 11th, and just a lot of different bases. And we're going on a whole base tour through the, I guess it'd be Southeast. We're going to be hitting Navy bases in Virginia and things of that nature. So I never stop touring. If there's an audition, you know, I'll stop, I'll audition. if I get the call back, then I might have to bust out to, you know, to LA, but I try to stay on the road and tour as much as possible.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just talking about, you know, the stress that soldiers get. I mean, obviously they're in stressful situations. Sometimes that comedy does break, you know, does help to relax you or break you down a little bit, you know, so you're not as stressed as you were. Both, you know, you know, performing in front of them or even, you know, with your program. I mean, just to, you know, I'm pretty sure a lot of these guys have some really, really, you know, really stories, but there might be a little bit of comedy in terms of some of that as well. I mean, how's been the reaction with some of these guys that you've worked with in terms of combat to comedy?
We, you know, they say comedy heals, but we've actually got to really see that in action. We were over in Kuwait performing, and, you know, we got to the base, and the base was really somber. Believe it or not, they'd had a suicide there on base, and we were supposed to perform. They were kind of expecting a lighter crowd for us that night because everything was going on. But I asked if we could talk to the base commander, and we did, and we're like, is it possible that we could go out to the unit and talk to the other troops out there? And so they was on the outskirts of the base, and they took us out there, and when we got there, they were coming back from a small service, just a remembrance service or whatever. And everybody's crying, and it was really emotional. But we started talking, we hugging, and instead of really focusing on the suicide, and the way I do my combat to comedy is, you know, let's focus on the good things. You know, not everything has to be bad. You know, a lot of the combat to comedy is built around five phases of grief, especially whether it's soldier or civilian life. It doesn't matter. You know, there's a lot of denial aspect that comes with when, you know, that's going on, anger, bargaining, depression. It really takes a while sometimes to get to the acceptance level of grief. And the way I try to deal with that is by finding funny in the dark places. And believe it or not, it's there. I watched it heal. Needless to say, after talking with this unit, we started heading back. And what originally was supposed to be, they thought was just a small venue, they ended up moving us into this hangar. And basically the whole base, we ended up performing in front of a little over 2,000 people that night because of just how the comedy started breaking it down. And word got around throughout the base that, you know what, we need to laugh, not cry. And by the time we started the show that night, here we get moved into this huge hangar, and everybody's laughing and having a good time. And we watched how laughter heals this unit and this base, and it was amazing. Coolest things I've ever been a part of. It really was awesome.
I mean, that's great. I mean, it just goes to show you how important, you know, and how combat to comedy is working. So, I mean, it's great to be able to see that you're starting to see some of those effects and really kind of seeing what's going on there as well. I mean, it's great to be able to see it's really it's well worth, you know, being a part of as well. So it's great to be able to hear that as well.
I appreciate
okay,
that.
anyway, my next guest is up here a little bit shortly, so let's go ahead and wrap a little bit. Like I said, you're going to be at the LA Comedy Club here in Vegas in September. You guys can check out he's going to be, you're pretty much, you know, doing your thing over in the LA area as well. You know, where can people find out where you're performing and, you know, what's going on with you?
You can find us on any of the Instagram, Facebook, whatever, the Veterans of Comedy. Go to our website, theveteransofcomedy.com. Check out our calendar, where we're going to be and what we're doing. Personally, you can also go to willc.net, which is my website personal, but I'm usually everything is posted over on the Veterans of Comedy. That's really where I'm focused at right now. And you'll be able to see what we're doing and where we're going to be and if we're going to be in your neighborhood. Stay in touch with us. Shoot us a message, info@theveteransofcomedy.com. If you'd like us to come to your neck of the woods, we'd be more than happy to do that. Just shoot us an email.
Yeah, I mean, if they're going to be up here anyway, I'm interested to see if any of the troops over at Nellis want you to have you guys over there as well. So
we love coming to Nellis.
Thanks for coming on the show. Well, it's been absolutely great to be able to pick your brain a little bit about comedy and great to hear, you know, all the stuff that you do for the troops as well.
Thank you,
we'll see you up here in September.
Sounds good. Have a good time. Thanks for having me on the show today. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, no problem at all. Well, we'll try to get you on before you get your butt up here.
Sounds good. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you. That was Will C, everybody. WillC.net, you guys can check that out as well. Veterans of Comedy, you guys can check out all that on social media as well. I mean, great guy. Like I said, it was kind of great kind of picking his brain a little bit. I love doing that with comedians, just picking their brain a little bit about the craft as well. I always feel a little guilty. They always say that, you know, we always make them laugh. But, you know, it's always interesting to kind of see their processes as well. So it was great to be able to have him on the show. My next guest is in queue right now by the looks of it. She's a very talented musician, and she was originally from Toronto, but makes her part-time home in Nashville, at least. Her new album is currently out, Stubborn in the Blood. Well, actually, it'll be released soon. The first single is already out, Let Them See You Strong, which has made a lot of waves. We'll talk a little bit about that. Her second single, a cover of One Tin Soldier, is set to be released hopefully relatively soon. She also has a children's book out called Jake the Road Dog, which helps raise funds and awareness for the Dolly Parton Imagination Library. Without further ado, let us get Tia McGrath on here. How are you doing, Tia?
Hi, Mark. I'm doing fabulous. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Are you currently out in Nashville, or are you up in Toronto at the moment?
I'm up on near Toronto, on beautiful the north shore of Lake Erie, and it's a lovely day. We're expecting some thunderstorms. I'm hoping that it doesn't crackle in our phone conversation, but it's a beautiful day. Great to talk with you. Thank you for having me on the show today.
Not a problem at all, Tia. You know, Toronto's always an interesting scene. I get a lot of musicians from the area. Everywhere from rock to country, pretty much out of that area. I mean, how is it for you to be from Toronto and kind of be in what's pretty much I'd almost say the LA of Canada, when it comes to has big as music scene as it is up there. How is it for you to be up there and just have those opportunities to perform and to be able to be in the city?
You know, it's I was really blessed and lucky to I was born here in Southern Ontario, and which if you take the population of all of Canada, kind of the majority of the population is here. Like you mentioned, Toronto is kind of the LA of Canada. And so I cut my teeth. I entered the Canadian Open Country Singing Contest. I won that. From there, I was able to go on to a CBC TV show with Johnny Cash and June Carter. And that's kind of what kickstarted my career. And then I was able to work with songwriters and artists like Randy Bachman from Bachman Turner Overdrive, Dan Hill. And then eventually I moved down to Nashville. But now we've got, you know, Toronto's also, they call it Hollywood North. And so a lot of films are happening up here, a lot of TV shows and everything. And so it's a really great environment. Like you said, I mean, it's got a great rock scene, country scene, everything. It's very diverse. And I think that's what I love about it so much is the diversity of it. And that you can, but yet at the same time, you have to be your own artist. You know, you can kind of find your own thing here and go out into the world and share that, which is what my husband and I are doing.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of a shift now. I mean, over the past decade that, you know, it used to be that you had to be at a certain spot. You had to be in LA. You had to be in New York to be able to put out an album. Nowadays, there are places like in Toronto or smaller cities that do have a pretty good studios where you're going to be able to record and all that as well. I mean, how's it for you? I mean,
absolutely.
Have you recorded a lot in Toronto? I mean, obviously you've recorded in Nashville as well. I mean, how has that been for you?
Yeah, I mean that's absolutely right. The last CD that I released called Crazy Beautiful, we received like a first round Grammy nomination for it for Americana Album, and that one. You know, we went to Austin, we recorded some tracks, in Toronto, we recorded some tracks in Nashville. This one, we focused more on our home studio. And what we did was Tommy would lay down the basic tracks here, our guitar, scratch guitar, the click track and everything, scratch vocal, then send down the tracks to our friends down in Nashville. and have them do their parts and send them back. And it was really awesome because we were able to build this process and build the album over about a year's span while we were on the road even. So we'd come home from the road and have a few days off and work on a track here and there. We also co-wrote a song called Forbidden with some friends of ours from Liverpool when we were over in England last year. And we just loved their the bass ukulele that Henry played on it and the guitar and their harmonies. So we were able to send the track over to them, have them put their parts on it and send it back to us here. And then we had the wonderful Nick Blagona. He mixed and mastered it here in Toronto. So this is the great thing about, you know, about our age, what we're in doing music, is that you can book gigs from here. You can do interviews. You can do everything pretty much, you know, over the internet or whatever. The cool thing is, though, we still get to go out on the road and reach our fans face to face, you know, sitting in an audience with them.
Yeah, you know what? You know, it's just a crazy thing. I mean, I've had a couple of country artists on here, and they do very well in Europe. It's just kind of crazy to think that, you know, you'd think that Europe would be more towards, you know, towards rock or more towards some of the classical stuff, but they just devour country a lot. There's a huge fan base out there for it. I mean, have you had the opportunity to tour out there? And I mean, what's been the reaction out there?
Yeah, well, Tommy and I were living in Nashville. That's where we met and got married. And so we started touring England about 12 years ago, the UK. And so we started over there. We started small. We were just playing little pubs. I did all the bookings myself. And while we were over there, we were really, really lucky and blessed to meet Bob Harris, who has a show over there called Whispering Bob. And he's a big icon over in the UK. And so he heard some of our music and really liked it. And so he started playing it on his show. And that kind of launched us into getting into bigger gigs and everything. And so now we go over every year. Last year we were over there twice. We go over every year. We're going back over in September to release our Stubborn in My Blood CD. And we're playing castles. We're playing theaters. We play churches. We play community centers, music venues, everything. It's just great. And our fans are so loyal, and they just love the stories, you know, behind songs. And I think the cool thing about European fans too are they don't really seem to be bothered with how, you know, how, if you're a multi-platinum selling artist or what you are, as long as the music is good and it reaches them, that's what they care about. That's what they'll buy a ticket for.
Yeah, you know, like I said, it's interesting. It's interesting, an interesting scene over there right now. Just the way that, like I said, they just absolutely are digging some of the country that's coming out over here as well. I mean, you know, Grant, kind of dialing back to maybe your first ever session, you know, in a recording studio. First of all, can you tell me kind of, you know, what it was like for that, you know, to be able to work in a studio for once? And second, you know, just looking back at what you were working with back then versus what you're working with now, I mean, obviously a night and day difference, right?
What a beautiful question. Thank you for that. Wow, that just takes me back. Well, I had won the Canadian Open Country Singing Contest, and with that I won some free recording time in a studio, and it was in Niagara Falls, and a cash prize. So with my cash prize, I bought myself a little guitar, and taught myself three chords and wrote a song. And I decided to take that song into the studio and record it for my free recording time. And so I remember my mom and dad drove me down to Niagara Falls, and we went into the studio, and the people who owned it were so lovely. They were just, you know, they knew I was a nervous little, you know, girl just starting out. And so they were really great. And so we recorded, I think, two songs. And I just remember falling in love with the whole process. To that point, I had been on stage. I'd been doing like musicals and things like that. But being in the studio was a whole other avenue for me. And of course, writing a song and then seeing it brought to life by the musicians and everything and the whole recording process. I remember my sister went with me, and she was like, at the end of the day, she says, "Oh my God, I just hate this." I said, "I love it. I love it. This is what I want to do." So now, flash forward, here we are, you know, I won't say how many years later, but that everything digitally, you're doing it over the internet, you're doing everything. So in some ways, you lose that aspect of being in the studio with everyone around you. But on the other hand, you get to draw on so much more talent, because if you want a player on it, you just say, hey, you know, are you available and would you like to play on my song? And then you can ship it off to them and they'll play on it if it works out. So, you know, everything has changed a lot, but it's still the recording process. I just loved, like, hearing a song that you've created and you've written bring to life, knowing that eventually you can get it out to your fans and your audience and move them, hopefully, in the same way. And this album, the Stubborn in My Blood album, I usually am very critical with my projects. And I will sit down, even when we're done listening to the master, and I'll be, oh, my gosh, I could have done that vocal better or whatever. But this one, we sat down, and I listened from top to bottom, and I was crying, and I said to Tommy, my gosh, we've captured something here that's really, really moving, and I hope it touches people the way, I don't care what people say, really. From an artist standpoint, this is my masterpiece, and I'm proud to present this to the world.
What's your writing process? Do you kind of get the tune first, or do you work on the lyrics first, or it just depends on what comes to mind?
Yeah, well, when Tommy and I were introduced to each other down in Nashville, they like Rising Youth, so they know how to pair you up with someone, whether you're a melody writer or whether you're a lyricist. And so when Tommy and I were introduced, he was major melody guy. I mean, he sits there with his guitar and he's got a big Guild guitar, and he just sits there and plays melodies and writes melodies all day long. So I said, okay, I'll focus on the lyrics. And so it's worked out really well for us. And so what we'll do, we might have a title, we might have an idea for a song. For example, Stubborn in My Blood, my relatives are Scottish Transylvanian. So one day Tommy said, was saying something like, you're stubborn or you're determined or something. And I said, well, Tommy, I've got stubborn in my blood, you know? And so we just sat down and he kind of heard the idea and thought, you know, this is kind of like an East Coast Celtic kind of vibe. And so he started jamming out this melody, and it just kind of led to this lyric. And we even fit the word Transylvania in it. So that's the way our writing process goes. And it seems to work for us, and we're so in tune with each other that now we just kind of sit down and it comes naturally for us.
Yeah, I got two questions I'd love to ask. I love to ask musicians whenever I get on. The first one is, what's probably the quickest you've ever written a song?
I would say half an hour. Sometimes they just come out like that. And the longest one was a song. It was called Two Wolves, and it's based on a Cherokee folk legend about the inner called Two Wolves, where the grandfather's talking to the grandson. And the grandson says, you know, I have this inner struggle going on with me. What is it? And the grandfather says, well, let me tell you the tale of two wolves. And Tommy is Native American, Shoshone, and Spanish. And so he really when we heard this idea about two wolves, he really wanted to make sure that we captured the integrity of the Native American story. So it took a while. I mean, we chewed on this one for maybe 2 years. And then finally one day we just sat down and started writing it and really took our time with it. So, you know, I believe the songs are out there, and we kind of just have to be the vehicle for them to come through. And sometimes we'll have to grow into those songs. They teach us too, as well as we're writing them.
Okay, I have a follow-up question, but I want to get to the other question that I always ask people. Does Tommy have a name for his guitar?
No, he doesn't.
Okay.
I don't think so. Not that he's told me, anyway.
Okay, yeah. The follow-up question to that is the fact, I mean, it kind of goes with what you were talking about, was the fact that a lot of people will actually have an idea or an idea for a lyric or something like that, and they may store it away, you know, may have it in a notebook or something like that. Do you still have some of the old notebooks, And do you ever look back and see if there's anything that you that kind of comes to mind when you need an idea?
Absolutely. I call mine a hookbook. And I take it everywhere with me. I mean, it's, you know, it goes on the road with us. It's been over to England. It's been to Wales. It's been to Scotland. It's been to Los Angeles, to, you know, all over the place. And I just carry this little hookbook with me. And because, you know, if you don't write it down or you don't record it, then you'll forget it, you know, and it'll be a brilliant idea. Someone will say something and it'll catch your ear, or you read something in a newspaper or something or a magazine, and inevitably when you go to write it, you'll have forgotten it. So I do, I keep them with me, and just, you know, I draw on those, like, you know, even this album, you know, there's songs that we'll kind of jot down and sketch out, and then it may be a year or two later and you just pull them out and it's time to write them, time to let them be.
Yeah, what's kind of interesting is that I talk to a lot of artists that just you know, use their phones now to kind of write down melodies or record quick, you know, little melodies on their phone as well. And, you know, we kind of are losing the idea of just having, you know, things written down and, you know.
Oh, I know, I know.
You know?
Well, you know, and there's something about writing it down, you know, that you remember it. Like, I used to, that's how I used to memorize all my lyrics, would I write them out, you know. And when I was writing my children's book, Jake the Road Dog, I thought, well, I could sit here with, you know, in front of my computer or whatever with my phone and just kind of write on notebook or something. And I thought, no, I want to write it out. So, you know, I did the old writing it out and crumple up the paper and throw it away and that whole thing. And there's, to me, I just love just writing it out, like journaling, you know. It frees your soul somehow and gets the creative aspect of it out there, I think, more than just kind of typing it out or whatever, you know, putting in your phone.
Yeah,
but
know,
then it's good,
yeah,
to record the melodies on your phone, right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, yeah, for me, I mean, it's just, you know, I can't, you know, I can't type fast, you know, and sometimes, you know,
mm-hmm.
your connection between your brain and your fingers aren't really the greatest when it comes to a keyboard, but when it comes to a pen, you know, you got
mm-hmm.
that inert thing, or where you could just simply free write really, really quick.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's a dying
mm-hmm.
art. Speaking of the book, I mean, how did that idea come about?
Well, you know, and if I may, before I get into that, that's a nice segue, because I was just talking to our CEO of the library here, and she was telling me, you know, that not only is writing, cursive, you know, writing becoming a dying art with children, like in school, they're not doing it because of, you know, being able to use phones and everything, and texting, but they're also having problems like speaking because now they're texting and everything so much. And so the whole thing with the Dolly Parton Imagination Library, which is really cool, is I wrote my children's book, and then I realized and discovered that Norfolk County, where we kind of live, is started a chapter of the Dolly Parton Imagination Library. And Dolly has donated over 1 million books around the world to children and their ages, newborn up to ages 5, and they get a book mailed to them once a month. And so I wrote my book, Jake the Road Dog. We rescued him in Nashville when we were living there. And he was on the road with us so much and has so many wonderful stories that I thought one day, you know what, I'm just going to capture the life of the road dog, the life of the musician through his eyes, and tell the story about friendship and insecurities, overcoming your insecurities and finding the song in your heart. And so I finished it last fall, and then ended up self-publishing and getting it into bookstores. And we go into libraries and schools and, you know, and donate some of the proceeds to the Dolly Parton Imagination Library up here in our community.
That's great. It's been, and again, you know, libraries are dying too, you know, because people read a lot more online than they, you know, they'll read on their Kindles more than they'll read, you know, read in, you know, in their libraries nowadays too. So those are dying out a little bit in terms of, you know, in terms of having to read books and all that as well. And there's something to be, there's a textile thing in holding a book versus, you know, having to hold a tablet or something like that, you know, it's just, you know, and again, that's another thing. It's kind of one more of a dying art, you know, and kind
you
of
know,
like how people are now. Go ahead.
Exactly. But, you know, I think that libraries in general are recognizing that. So they're starting to do a lot of extracurricular programs. I just heard of one that we might be helping to launch up here. And it's like a songwriting community where songwriters will get together maybe, you know, once a week or once a month or whatever in the library and encourage an audience to show up. And it's free, you know, and but local songwriters will get to play their songs and an audience comes in and you're surrounded by books. And so we've been doing some more of these. And I also noticed that they're doing a lot more kids programs this summer as well to get kids, you know, get them out of sitting at home watching TV or on the computer and get them out interacting with other children their own age and involved in programs and activities.
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, I kind of look back to vinyl that maybe that'll happen with books too, in the fact that, you know, people want something physically to hold or whatever. And, you know, they may like the way it is in a different kind of way, you know, that the old technology sometimes, you know, kind of humbles you a little bit. And, you know, sometimes you just like to have a little, you know, do a little work to be able to do it. And it may not sound 100% clear or read into 100% clear, but, you know, seriously, you know.
I know, isn't it? I mean, just to hold a book in your hand, you know, those days when you were a kid or something and you were hiding, you know, to read your book and you're turning the pages and just, or sitting in the backyard under a tree or something in the summer, you know, and drinking a lemonade and you're caught up in this mystery or something, you know, it's just, there's something about that, isn't there? It's just amazing. You can't replace that.
Yeah. Now let's change gears here. Let's talk about this new single. Let them see you're strong. You know, how's been, it seems like there's a huge reaction to it. How's it been for you to be able to see some of the reaction that you've been getting from the song?
You know, this was such an amazing blessing. We wrote this with our good friend Devin O'Day down in Nashville. And Devin had this idea. She had started the song, Let Them See You're Strong, and strong is a noun in it. So it's your, Y-O-U-R. And so we were down there visiting with her, and she said, you guys want to help me finish a song? And we said, sure. So this just came out, and I mean, we're like sitting around the three of us, and let them see you're strong, let them see you burn, let them see your light, you know, and it became this huge empowerment anthem for us. And so we recorded it and put it on our album, and immediately when I put it out there, people were just like messaging me saying, oh my gosh, I needed to hear this. I needed to hear this. This is so encouraging. And I even got a call from a ladies empowerment group out of Dallas, Texas, and they asked me if they could use it as their theme song. There's an artist out of Nashville now who's recorded it. So I'm excited to hear that when it's finished. And so it's just one of these songs that just seems to be capturing people's hearts and saying something to them.
Yeah, you know, it's great to be able to see that, you know, sometimes when a song has such a strong reaction and touches so many people that way, you know, I mean, my previous guest, you know, to be able to have, you know, the opportunity to work with the military and to be able to reach out to them and really make a huge impact. I mean, that's, you know, that's just something huge as well. I mean, it's
absolutely
great to be able to see a single this kind of thing. You know,
yeah, and I really,
you know,
yeah,
see,
that's what I really want to see is that, you know, that the song gets out there, you know, that is used in that way. As a songwriter, that's what you want. You know, you want the song to be a vehicle for people to inspire them, to let them find their courage and their strength and everything. So it's we're pretty excited to see where this one's going to go.
When's Winston Soldier going to be out?
Our official release date is August 13th. And so we're doing a little video with that, and we're planning on releasing it out to the world, and then we hit the trail running over to England, to the UK for September. And then when we get back, we're going to start focusing on setting up our January, February tour to come down to the States and do a lot of little radio show type things, which is going to be really cool. So we're excited about that. And already, again, we're getting great feedback with One Tin Soldier. We're doing it live, and people who are hearing it and reviewing the album are saying, you know, they're so happy to see the song brought back, and it's refreshing. And we thought it was timely, fits in with what's going on in the world right now and kind of speaking for people's minds.
Yeah, I mean, it's great to hear. I mean, it's really important, again, to kind of get out there as well. So it'll be interesting to see once that comes out. Did you guys shoot a single for Let 'Em See You're Strong?
We didn't do a video. I'm sorry, did you say a video or a single?
Video.
No,
yeah,
we
video.
Didn't do a video with that one. I would like to. I would like to do something with that. So we'll work on that. But right now we're working on the One Tin Soldier.
Yeah, that's great. It would be nice for you guys to come out when the rodeo is out here. I mean, it's, you know, they usually bring a lot of country acts out here. I'd love to see if at some point you'd be come out here or whatever, but we'll have to see,
I
guess.
Oh, that'd be fantastic. Yeah, I'd love that.
Yeah. So the single's coming out in August. You guys can check that out as well. You're touring in Europe, and then we won't have any more dates probably until next year. Anything else going on with you? Anything else you need to promote?
That's pretty much it. You know, we got the album. We're going to have, I've still got my Jake the Road Dog. If anyone wants to buy our music or buy my book, you can get my information at Tia McGrath. com, and it's TIAMCGRAFF as in Frank .com. And I'm also on social media, of course. And Jake has his own Facebook page as well, Jake McGrath. You can find him on there. And we're just really anticipating some great things coming up, and people are loving the music, loving the book. So we're looking forward to seeing you in Las Vegas very soon. Hopefully we can pull that together.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, they always bring some really great country acts out here as well. I mean, it'd be interesting to see, you know. I don't think we get too many Toronto acts, strangely enough, and that you guys have a really growing scene up there. So it'd be interesting to be able to see that as well. So that's great to be able to as well. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. And, you know, it's great to be able to have you on the show again. And we'll have to talk a little bit later on this year, maybe, once you guys start setting up your schedule again. You know, best of luck with the new with the album coming up, and congratulations on all the success with the singles. Like I said, we'll definitely talk to you later down the line. I definitely have a lot more questions I want to talk to you about. But
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. This has been really fun, and thank you for your questions. I mean, you know, these really is for an artist to journey back through your life, you know, and kind of think about things. This is really nice. Thank you very much.
Oh, not a problem at all, Tia. And again, best of luck to you in the upcoming year. And I really look forward to seeing the video for the One Tin Soldier. And we'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Have a great day. Thank you.
Okay. Yep. That was Tia McGrath, everybody. You guys can check her out. Tia McGrath on all social media, TiaMcGrath.com. You guys can check out where you can buy her singles and her album, and where she's going to be touring. If you guys are listening over in Europe, she'll have some tour dates hopefully posted over there as well. And also you can buy her book, so make sure you check that out as well. We should be back next week. I have a couple people, I think, in line and lined up. I just got to get contact with them. So I'll be posting that show, me more than likely, usually on Wednesdays or Thursdays, usually when I get confirmation. So guys can check that out as well. At SWIV on Twitter, and Somewhere in Vegas on Facebook. You guys can check that out as well. And with that in mind, we'll see you guys next week, 2 p.m. Pacific and 5 p.m. Eastern time. We'll talk to you guys then.